Hello, it's Ed, and welcome to another episode of Transmission. Today, we're joined by Gethin Musk, who is the head of trading at OVO. OVO are a retail supplier for the GB market. We cover lots of the ins and outs of how do you actually hedge for a retail portfolio. We then go on to talk about how batteries might be involved in this mix. And then finally, we start to talk about some of the things that might reduce costs for consumers in the long term, as well as if you're someone interested in energy trading and perhaps hedging of portfolios, how might you get into a team like that? I think it's a very useful and candid conversation. I can't wait to hear what you think about it. Let's jump in. Hello and welcome to another episode of Transmission. Today I'm joined by Gethin Musk, who is head of trading at OVO. Gethin, welcome.
Thanks, Ed.
And so we're just going to come to you straight away and say, how do you fit into OVO? What is your role?
So you've already said I'm the head of trading at OVO. So my team's responsible for ultimately buying the gas and electricity that we buy to meet our customers' needs. So, you know, from within day to right out to kind of 2 years ahead, buying gas and electricity in lots of different ways to try and meet their needs.
Okay. And your sort of context within the energy space, how long have you been doing this for?
Too long. So right when I started, I was a graduate at E.ON in E.ON Energy Trading back in 2004. So I'm not going to count the years, but a surprisingly long time. I was there doing various different roles in power and gas trading for 5 or 6 years. And then I was at Npower, that at the time was a domestic and industrial energy retailer, in part the RWE group, for 9 or 10 years, and left there 3.5 years ago. I joined OVO.
Okay, superb. And I think that gives people real context that we have a real expert on retail hedging on today. So hoping to get into all of that detail.
Okay.
And just to then round that off, so who are OVO? What do they do? What portion of GB do they supply?
So OVO is a pure domestic energy retailer. So we supply about 4 million customers. And we've been around since 2009 and growing sort of, I guess, relatively rapidly since then. Now, I don't even know if it's a big five or a big six or whatever anymore, but we're kind of one of the largest suppliers in the UK. So we supply, I think, like 12% of UK domestic demand. I'm not quite sure for total industrial demand as
okay.
well.
Okay, and let's get straight into it. So how do suppliers buy energy?
So there's a variety of different methods that different companies might use, but for OVO and previously for Npower, we went and bought our electricity and gas from the wholesale market. So we would buy that over the course of a number of years before delivering to customers on a daily basis or a half hourly basis. And we would do that either through direct transactions with a counterparty or working with a partner. So OVO has a partner called Shell who provide our route to market services, and we use that to kind of enable us to access to the wholesale market.
Okay. And when you say kind of going and buying this, this is someone looking at a screen, seeing a kind of a chunk of power available mm-hmm. to be purchased for yeah. 2 years out from now. And then they will kind of click on that and buy what they need.
Yeah. So if you go back to the points prior to purchasing, we have to kind of forecast how much we think our customers are going to need on a daily or half hourly basis, daily for gas and half hourly for power. And then we will purchase that over a period of time ahead of supplying to those customers. And that time scale over which we'll purchase is dependent on the contractual obligations that we have with those customers. So the majority of our customers are currently on the price cap. So that's a price effectively set by Ofgem. And Ofgem set that price through assessing how much the energy that a retailer will cost for them to buy over a period of time. So we will try and match that. So we'll go out and buy in line with their assessment period every day over the course of, say, 3 months or something like that. And then that will mean that we've bought energy at a price that we can charge that's in line with what we're able to charge to our customers.
Okay. And so just kind of doing that from start to finish. So let's go 3 years ahead of time. So we're 2025. So we're thinking about 2028 energy. Will you have already started purchasing energy for 2028 today?
Not generally. So the majority of our customers are, as I say, on the price cap. And then we have some customers who might be on, say, 12 or 18 month tariffs or something like that. So when a customer goes and says to us, I'd like to fix my energy costs today, will effectively go and buy all of that energy need at that point. So we know that we've secured a contract with a customer, so they know the price that they're going to receive. We need to mitigate the risk around that, so we'll go out and effectively buy that at the same time. Yeah, so typically that will be up to 18 months ahead. So we'll have a view of customer demand, say 3 or 5 or even longer years ahead, but we won't be doing anything to hedge that at this point in time because we haven't got a contractual relationship with the customer. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So let's say, and there's probably two types of customer there. So there's the customer who will fix with you, and there's the customer who is on a sort of standard or kind of rolling contract.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so you'll kind of take a view for that rolling contract that there'll still be some of those customers there 18 months from now. In terms of that transaction you make 18 months ahead of time, so you know that at the end of 2026, you need whatever, 500 megawatt hours of energy. Yeah. Like, what do you buy today?
Let's assume that we know that customer is going to be there. Okay. So if there is uncertainty that at the end of their contract, they're going to be there or not, we might only buy a proportion of what we think they need. But if we've got certainty that they're going to go and buy there, we would buy all of their base load energy needs. And I guess we'll come onto base load in a minute as sort of at that point. So we would buy, if they needed 10 units every day, we'd go out and buy 10 units every day on average. It might be that on some days they need 20 units and some days they need 5. And that's when we have what we call a shape risk or an underlying shape exposure that we then have to kind of risk manage and try and optimize the hedging of that over time as liquidity allows.
Okay, so the product you go and buy today is base load.
Yeah.
And that is, say, 10 megawatts for 24 hours consecutively.
And exactly.
And the reason why you buy base load is because that's the only product that exists?
Yeah, so we talk quite a lot in Ova about liquidity. That can be quite a constraining factor for us. So that means whether you're able to transact in the wholesale market at a price that is reasonable and representative of, I guess, what you describe as fair value. So yeah, typically you might get 12 or 18 months worth of good liquidity for power, slightly better for gas on base load for power, and then you might get 12 months or so of liquidity for peak load, which is just during the middle of the day, so between 7 and 7 on Mondays to Fridays, but not at weekends at all.
Okay, so peak load is kind of, we're starting to build in this concept of shape. So you've got this base load, which is the same power throughout the whole course of the day. Then we've got peak load, which is then sort of getting rid of the off peaks, so when demand is typically or has been typically lower. And then so you start to get shape coming in terms of base load, then you get peak and off peak.
Yep.
How does that then progress to allow you to buy something that's kind of for a specific half hour?
So the granularity progresses as you get closer to delivery. So closer to real time, you get better granularity. So as I say, typically you may only buy 12 or 18 months ahead base load. And then inside 12 months, let's say peak liquidity improves as well. You then start to layer on extra products. So in particular, overnights. So that's basically 7 till 7. I'm going to have to check these dates, these times in case I get them wrong. 7 till 7 every day. Weekdays and weekends. When we bought baseload energy for our customers, most of our customers are asleep overnight. And so we don't actually need that demand, that supply in the middle of the night. So that's something we would like to sell back into the market and buy more peaks or other bits and pieces where our customers are going to need more energy. So overnights might become available, say 6 to 12 months ahead. And then that improves with more granular products, individual blocks. So those are like 4-hour blocks down to half hours. And we can only really trade half hours day ahead and intraday.
Okay, so the kind of the overnights and peaks is a kind of really nice way of kind of getting to shape. So you've bought this base load, but as you say, your customers are asleep overnight and will be putting on kettles at 5 o'clock in the day. So you need to buy more energy in those peaks and you need to sell the overnights.
Yeah.
And that same principle kind of keeps on happening as you get more and more granularity, getting close to delivery.
Yeah.
Do you feel like there's enough liquidity in that market to let you kind of sort out your shape and get you to the position that matches your consumers, or is it kind of constantly a battle to try and find products that are good enough?
So I and my team spend a lot of time trying to find that liquidity, working with other partners, trading partners in the market, and trying to stimulate liquidity in the market by showing a price at which we're willing to buy or sell in the wholesale market, and that sometimes results in sudden sporadic liquidity that allows us to better shape our position. But quite a lot of the time, you're kind of shouting into the void.
Yeah.
And the liquidity isn't great. It's probably a bit of a disconnect between the natural, let's say, sellers of SHAPE who have enormous portfolios of power stations and things like that and are kind of managing big hedges worth billions and billions and billions of pounds, and retailers who arguably are very concerned about SHAPE because of a relatively low margin business, and the change in value of those things could cost us money quite quickly. So we're really keen to try and get stuff done to try and mitigate the risk associated with it. Arguably, sometimes the people on the other side of the market are less worried about those, what they would see as little bits.
Yeah. I think there's kind of two really interesting things in there. So one is a seller of SHAPE. Who is a seller of SHAPE?
Yeah. So ultimately, if you think about it, the amount of supply in the wholesale market at delivery has to match the amount of demand. Yeah. But the demand all comes from one source, customers, and the supply of that SHAPE effectively is made up of lots and lots of different suppliers, right? So gas-fired power stations might do what's called two shifting or something like that. So they might operate in the morning and the evening, or they might just sell during the middle of the day and then turn off overnight. And then you've got batteries that might also kind of sit either side of that and deal with some super peak pieces. Then you've got things like pump storage, where people get water and they basically pump it up the mountain and then let that go, and it comes down and goes through a turbine, and that can, like, you know, create a lot of energy very quickly for a small amount of time. But all of those different suppliers of SHAPE might have interest or lack of interest, arguably, at different times to kind of transact in the wholesale market. So it can be difficult for us to kind of fit everything together, if that makes
okay.
sense.
Okay. Yeah. No, it does make sense. And then the kind of the final part. So then going into delivery. So what happens if you get this wrong? What happens if you can't shape what you've bought to what your demand looks like?
Yeah. So we tend to have put some more refined hedges on. So we start with the base load, and then we might have bought peaks and sold some off peaks or sold some overnights, maybe a bit of block five, which is that, as you talked about, that evening peak after 5 o'clock. But we realize that we've got a lot of daily SHAPE. So different demand on different days. Actually, our highest demand from our customers is over the weekends, because everyone's at home, basically, and SHAPE within the day. So we will resolve a lot of that at the day ahead market. So in the auction, so the N2EX and the EPEX auctions. So those are hourly. And then we do another refinement to half hourly in the afternoon auction as well. And then we're obviously reforecasting, getting revised views of customer demand all the time. So we'll then transact intraday under the EPEX intraday market as well.
Okay. And if you miss, if you get it wrong, what happens?
Oh, yeah. So we will run into imbalance, basically. The imbalance market is where the grid operator effectively has to take actions to match supply and demand. So if suppliers don't meet their demand with enough energy purchases or supply into the market, the grid operator takes remedial action to make sure that everything matches up. The cost of that remedial action, or the marginal cost of that remedial action, effectively is then charged back to all of those players who are out of balance. So if you haven't bought enough, you'll have to buy extra at that remedial price. If you've supplied too much into the market, the same thing applies. You'll only receive the remedial price, and that price can be really high or really low depending on the actions that the operator has to take.
And that drives an incentive to be sort of in balance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the let's say OVO had bought nothing and just went intraday really, really short, then the operator would have to take lots and lots of actions at potentially very, very expensive price. And that would be extremely detrimental. And you run a lot of risk. If you run all of that into delivery, there's a lot of uncertainty about the price, where the price might end up. We don't want to do that on behalf of our customers, because we want to be a kind of stable and trusted energy supplier. So hedging and providing certainty that we're always going to be there for our customers is really important.
Okay. No, it's really interesting. We've kind of ticked off SHAPE risk. I wonder if this is going to go too far, but it'd be nice to talk about swing risk very quickly.
So
a little bit of this is kind of retail hedging kind of always loses effectively.
Yep.
Perhaps we could just talk about some of the conditions when it's warmer than expected.
Yeah.
What happens? How does that sort of equation play out when it's warmer than expected?
Yeah, okay. So most customers in the UK, not all, but the majority, heat their home through gas. So they've got a boiler. When they get in and it's cold, the heating is already turned on, or they will go and turn the heating on or something like that. We, based on our forecast of temperatures across the course of the year, so we talked about seasonal normal temperatures. So that's kind of on average what you would expect the temperature to be at a given time. We can forecast the amount of energy that our customers will need to heat their homes predominantly. When that temperature is warmer, like that can either be kind of lots of cloud cover, meaning the temperature is kept or the air is kept warmer in the UK, or there's lots of sun that's kind of creating solar radiation in people's windows like here and heating everybody up. That can reduce or change the customer's behavior. So they might not turn their heating on, or if they've got an automated kind of heating system, then it may just take less actions to keep their home warm. In that scenario, we've gone out and bought 1,000 units of gas to supply our customers. And all of a sudden, because it's really warm, we only need 600 units of gas because their boilers run less. So we have to sell that excess gas that we've purchased back into the wholesale market to make sure that we're hedged and we don't end up with an imbalance effectively. We don't end up with gas that we don't need. Same for power. We're one part of a domestic supply business or industry, and all those other industry players are probably doing the same thing. And industrial customers are probably doing the same thing as well. So you almost get a situation where everyone is selling when it's warm, when you need to be selling as well. And similarly, if it's cold, the price will tend to go up when it's cold as well. So if your customers are cold and feeling that they need to turn their heating up, they'll do so. They need the extra gas. We'll go out and buy that. But everyone else is doing that as well. So when you need the gas, the price is high. When you don't need the gas, the price is low. So it's not quite right to say you always lose, but you kind of always lose in those situations. Yeah. There can be other things that go on as well that break that, like a Ukraine crisis or something of that sort, or whatever, that move gas price for not fundamental reasons, but predominantly irrespective of those external factors. Yeah, and swing is kind of always a cost for a retailer.
I think it's a fascinating insight into how do people, or what do people have to think about on these desks when they're thinking about retail hedging. It's one of those complex things that when it's explained to you, you think, oh, actually that does kind of make sense. But outside of that process, never having kind of thought it through, it just doesn't seem so obvious.
I mean, I think one of the things I like about energy and energy retailing is it all comes back to reality and people's behaviours and the decisions that they make. So things like the energy crisis changed people's behaviours a bit, and we've seen that become a permanent change, and therefore we've had to adjust the way in which we forecast our customer demand and all that kind of thing. And you know, that has a real effect. Like during the energy crisis, I personally got solar panels on my roof. For me as a customer of OVO, that's changed my profile and the way in which I consume energy. At scale, on a macro scale, lots of people doing that has a really material effect on the way the whole energy system works. Mm. It's really interesting.
Well, as a supplier, that must be really interesting for you, right? So you've just talked about how you think about getting energy in for customers almost 18 months ahead of time, thinking about almost the half hour by half hour consumption. Mm. When a customer goes and gets a solar panel on their roof, that again completely changes 100%, their consumption, right? So you must be having to think quite a lot as a company in how you hedge for these customers, that actually the shape of what their consumption looks like is actually, in a net zero world, could be totally different.
100%.
Not only solar panels, but EV, heat pump.
Yeah, 100%. I think EV is a really interesting one, right? So I mentioned a lot of our demand is at the weekend. So typically when you think of a retail business that applies businesses and customers, they will have their biggest demand in the middle of the day, driven by industrial customers, and then will tend to have lower demand over the weekends and stuff like that. For a domestic energy retailer, so just you and me, I hope you're an OVO customer, Ed. He's not answering.
Yeah, no comment. I have been.
You have been. I'll take that. Yeah. that demand is very different then. So we have evening peaks and then weekends where our demand is highest. EVs change that again. But EVs are really interesting because they're not necessarily just a one-way, or may not necessarily ultimately be a one-way thing. So we know that some suppliers developing, or some vehicle manufacturers are developing vehicle-to-grid capabilities. So everyone suddenly has a battery at home, which can be optimized. And even if it's just demand, there's a lot of interesting stuff around how suppliers will kind of try and help customers optimize that demand so that they can get the best price possible as well. And ultimately, that changes the way in which you forecast their demand as well.
Yeah, I think that's another kind of fascinating, it's as you say, it's kind of everything comes back to behaviors, but also it's things, it's the technologies that sit behind that that are then starting to change the whole picture. So it is very much at the edge of the transition. Just to ask a question about supply. So we've talked a lot about OVO here. Can we kind of take it as read that what you've described on OVO is very much how others think about it? Or do you see differing flavors of how to hedge in industry?
So I guess I've described a relatively low risk approach, trying to mitigate the risk because it's really important to be there. We are, for a better way of putting it, lucky. We have good credit available to us that allows us to hedge in ahead of time. For some suppliers, that may be more challenging. So one of the big consequences of the energy crisis has been around credit and liquidity. So to be able to trade in advance, you have to be a company of good standing who whoever you end up trading with is taking the risk against, essentially. So credit allows us to do that. If you're a supplier with less good credit for any number of reasons, then you may have to hedge over a shorter time frame because you may only be able to hedge 3 or 6 months ahead rather than 12 or 18, let's say. That potentially leaves you with different risks or potentially having to offer slightly different services to your customers and that kind of thing.
Okay, let's talk about credit and then let's go to the gas crisis because I think those two are really nicely linked. Let's start off with credit. Why do you have to post credit?
So if I want to transact with Ed Porter Electricity, I want to buy from Ed Porter Electricity.
It's a great deal.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
The best deal.
I will come to you and I'll say, I want to make a transaction with you. I will commit to buy electricity from you at £75 and I will do so November this year. Is that all right, Ed?
Perfect.
Okay, cool. But little do I know that Ed Porter Electricity is a bit of a shiesty operation.
Oh, no. I should never have signed up to this.
and is possibly going to go bust. So I think I've committed a contract with you for £75. And then in the intervening period, because you've been having too many parties, you've spent all your money and you've gone bust.
Yeah.
When it comes to it, all of a sudden, you're not supplying the energy that I've committed to at £75. In the intervening period, the price has gone to £100. So I need to go and acquire that energy for £100 instead. And because I thought I had committed to a deal with you, I've suddenly lost out on £25 that I had sort of baked into my plans and expected to be there effectively. And all of a sudden, I'm loss making on what I've bought that energy for versus what I thought I was going to be a profit-making position.
Okay, so everyone is kind of having to post credit to make sure that the kind of the change that happens within the market is covered by the kind of cash that's there.
Yeah, effectively. So rather than what the very unrealistic scenario that we've just talked about, I can't imagine you'd ever end up like that. We would have limited our exposures to each other. So we would say we'd only be able to buy, I don't know enough about you as an operation, I'll only buy 1 megawatt of electricity from you rather than 10, and then I'll spread the other 9 across other counterparties, therefore diversifying my risk, so I haven't got all my risk with one counterparty. And in addition, I may ask you to give me some money in advance or me to give you some money in advance to kind of offset and mitigate the risk of me or you not being there at that point.
Okay, so this all sounds very sensible and kind of a very pragmatic approach. Mm-hmm. When the market gets hit with kind of the shockwave that is things like a gas crisis, how does that change everything?
So the gas price, crisis resulted in prices that I don't think had ever been seen before in the market, not at least in my time, however long that is, far too long. It's probably almost certainly outside of any of the models. Yeah. So no one thought that you would end up with, I think it was £8 or so gas. For one day, I mean, that's absolutely insane.
What is gas price today, just for people who don't spend so long looking
about,
at it?
Let's say about £1. Okay. But that's historically really, really high levels. So long-term history, 50p was probably fairish. Very, very long time ago, it was 10p. Mm. You know, when the UK had lots of gas supply in and of itself, it was 10 to 12p a unit. Maybe we'll come on to that a bit later. So if I've got a position against you, I'm trying to assess how much risk I have. And we've transacted at today's levels, £1. I probably still don't think the market will end up at £8. And therefore, my risk distribution of how much I might lose is kind of not including that very, very, very old black swan tail event kind of thing.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
So when we get into the black swan tail event, if you're someone who's on one side of those contracts, if you're potentially losing out, you're saying, well, hold on, I've now got this really big exposure. So I had to go back to you and say, could you pass me more credit, more cash to cover that position?
Yeah. And if you're theoretically, so we probably shouldn't go into this too much, but I'll try and summarize in a very generic way. If you're a supplier who only has so much available credit and has to get money in from customers to be able to pay for the energy that you've been supplied, if all of a sudden I'm being asked to pay some post more and more cash, that's getting harder and harder to kind of balance the cash flow and stuff like that.
No, I think it's a super interesting space, and like it's kind of probably where retail hedging was at its most talked about. Was in the early 20s.
I never expected my industry to be the front page of the news, right?
Exactly. Okay, so perhaps then going on to the next topic I really want to cover. So we saw last year Octopus Energy sign a toll agreement with Gresham House Storage Fund. Gresham House own lots of batteries, and Octopus Energy obviously supply customers. And they signed this toll deal where effectively Octopus are going to do the trading for Gresham House's assets. And what's really interesting about it is that you think about consumers at home. I consume at 5 o'clock and I don't consume when I'm asleep, more or less. But a battery goes in the other direction. So a battery might be charging overnight and discharging into the 5 o'clock peak. Is that useful for a retail business to have both?
So a very long time ago, before the energy crisis, back in the old world, there used to be a concept of sort of vertical integration. Yeah, so that would mean that energy companies would have customers and generation assets, as was kind of gas-fired and coal-fired power stations, and potentially also wires businesses as well. And effectively, you use those as a hedge against each other. The difficulty that kind of I think lots of those industry or those big integrated energy companies found was they couldn't do everything brilliantly. So I talked about at the beginning about power station operators just being focused on kind of hedging their power stations and stuff like that. I think you might argue that those big companies that were vertically integrated spent all their time thinking about power stations and little time thinking about retailing and didn't optimize that very effectively. So there was a move in the industry to kind of break those off. So retailers became pure play retailers. Generation companies became carbon intensive generation. Then renewable companies maybe separated out as well. And you kind of saw a big change where the intention was that each of those types of industry would optimize. What you're describing is probably a little bit of a kind of reversal of that. And I could definitely see the case that having battery assets kind of offsets some of the risks associated with retailing. I can't talk about Octopus specifically because I don't know the details of their hedging operations, but you can definitely see why you would see those two things as natural offset. Having said that, batteries kind of are operated in a really dynamic way, yeah, much more so probably in outturn. So they get turned on and off 35 times, providing, you know, across a week or something, providing support for grid services, which is completely divorced from domestic energy supply and demand. But yeah, nonetheless, I can definitely see the rationale as to why those two things might fit together.
Yes. I suppose it comes down to, like, do you have the ability to find the products within the day ahead of the intraday market that match what you need as a someone who's responsible for the trading for a retail portfolio? And provided you can get that within day ahead and intraday, how much do you need this?
Yeah, exactly. So yes. So we make sure that we match our supply and demand by the day ahead market. The auctions definitely support that. So those are really important constituent of ultimately making sure that the energy system works. The arguably kind of some of the like the cost of transacting shape may be higher when the market is in a period of system stress, and clearly that's an opportunity for battery assets. At a portfolio level, they might well present a good hedge in the same way that I talked about, like integrated vertically integrated companies.
Yeah. I mean, going back to that, it's just a little bit early in the conversation, but going back to that kind of swing risk point, the kind of retailers always lose is kind of the maybe how I'd describe that.
So you
get a really high or really cold snap, really big cold snap that comes in, the retail position suffers because of that swing risk, but your battery position actually would perhaps welcome that volatility in that shape because it's really looking for the kind of biggest possible spread to trade between.
So
at a kind of top portfolio level, interesting, but as can I trade a particular half hour of power, you can kind of do that today.
Ultimately, you can match your needs. Yeah.
Okay, super, super interesting. So moving to from perhaps some real specifics to something far, far more general, which is that we often hear that energy in GB is expensive. Given your experience in the space, how do you think that we might be able to change the system to get bills down for consumers?
Yeah, so I think compared to historical norms, it is expensive now, but it's worth understanding the context of why that feels expensive now, which is that the UK historically had lots of gas fields out in the North Sea that it was able to exploit, so extract all the gas, and that resulted in very low gas prices in the wholesale market and therefore very low prices for consumers. Actually, at the time, the UK used to spend a lot of time exporting gas to the continent as well, and therefore kind of getting revenue into the UK, exchequer, et cetera, et cetera. Those gas fields have reduced in the amount of available supply significantly. So we are no longer able to meet our needs, both from a gas-fired power station perspective and a domestic and industrial demand perspective, through gas from those fields. So we now have to import gas from elsewhere. So the change is we were self-sufficient, and now we're part of a global market. Yeah. So we have to pay the global market price for gas and electricity as well, effectively. We've got lots of interconnection into Europe. We also have a lot of LNG terminals in the UK. So that allows people to send ships from the US or South America or from the Middle East or something with supercooled gas in the tanks, and then to deliver them into the UK, where they get sort of decompressed back into sort of the natural gas that you and I might see. But to pay that, to do that, you have to pay the price that the market is balancing at. And that is expensive compared to historical norms. It kind of is what it is. It sounds a bit flippant. Go on.
So then going from...
To build on that.
Yeah, to build on that, going from the, like, what has happened to how do we get to a world where we can see relatively lower bills?
So there is some normalization. So we talked a little bit about when gas was kind of £2, £5, £8 a unit. It's around £1 a unit. And I guess it's worth pointing out, I use gas because a lot of power prices are kind of indexed to gas price, is determined by gas. So we've returned to a more normal world, but customers' bills are still, what, £1,600, £1,700 on average. That's still expensive for customers. To go back to, let's say, £1,000 bills or something, we probably need a world where the UK and Europe are more energy independent. Yeah, so how do you solve for that? You could choose to exploit lots of the gas that's caught in rocks and stuff through fracking and all of that kind of stuff. Personal opinion, I imagine probably Ovo's opinion as well, is that that's not a good solution for the climate crisis. Renewables has to be a bigger part of the solution. That can't be part of the solution on its own because of the complexity of the energy system. You need batteries and you need inertia. It's probably a bit technical, but you need the ability to increase or decrease supply very, very quickly in particular reasons. But increasing the amount of renewables and backup capabilities to kind of manage the variation in renewable supply is really important.
Yeah, I think geologists would also agree that fracking for GB is just not suited to the geology that we have. Mm. So even though it's very successful in the US and it's keeping US prices very low, it's not the same thing for GB. What's really interesting is that link between gas and power prices. So the UK is very linked in that the power price is set by the marginal plant, so the last plant to turn on. Yep. That is often a gas unit and historically has nearly always been a gas unit. The really interesting thing that we're now starting to see is that on some days, you're starting to see times when those last gas units are being turned off. Yep. That's quite exciting. So for example, last year we saw day ahead markets, we saw around 180 hours of negative pricing. Mm-hmm. And those are kind of periods where clearly gas isn't setting the price because gas doesn't turn on for a negative price. It doesn't want to pay to generate.
Yeah.
But that's more of a phenomenon where we're starting to see that kind of the renewable portfolio just starting to peek through on this kind of price setting.
100%.
Okay, so last year we saw, in terms of the power prices in GB, we saw 175 to 180 hours of negative prices on the day ahead market, which are times when the renewable portfolio and renewable fleet is starting to kind of turn off those last gas units, and it creates a negative price, and all of a sudden the link between gas prices and power prices is broken. Do you think that that is a way that we can ensure lower bills for consumers, or do we need something more radical?
So you're describing the effect of renewables and nuclear fleet displacing gas entirely from the system. Negative prices are slightly complex to kind of to explain, but in any but the simple way of thinking about it is there's too much electricity for what customers are demanding at that point in time. That needs to be smoothed out one way or another, and obviously one way of achieving that is through batteries. Batteries have an associated cost with them, but those negative prices support a business case for batteries to be built and therefore smooth out that's imbalance. It is clearly a sign that renewable penetration is getting larger and larger, but there are points when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining, et cetera, where gas at the moment is still really important. So we're in a really sunny period right now. And during, by about, I don't know, 10 a.m. till, say, 4 p.m., we're getting lots of solar production. But most people are waking up between 6 and 9 a.m. I was thinking about you and your baby then, or your child then.
Yeah.
4:30 and 9 a.m.
Yeah.
And turning their kettles on or whatever it might be. And that kind of additional demand at that point in the day still has to be met at the moment by gas-fired power station. Same thing applies at the end of the day. So as the solar sort of tails off, as the sun goes down, something needs to come in and ramp it out. Realistically, gas is likely to be part of that solution for a time yet, until you've got so much alternative flexibility, I guess, predominantly provided by batteries on the system to kind of compensate for that.
Okay, no, really interesting. And those kind of within Europe as well, we're starting to see at the start of March, we had some strong solar periods. Prices in Germany went down to near zero. On the continent, I think for yesterday, we had some negative pricing at the start of March, which feels crazy considering
that's
like
really does,
solar driven, right?
Yeah.
It just feels very odd to not be in summer or just out of winter and already solar is kind of driving those negative prices.
But I think it's interesting in the context of being winter and a sunny day driving that. And then on the other hand, we had the Dunkelflaute period.
So, cold weather, low winds, and for like a prolonged period of time.
And just grey.
Just
like horrible, not very nice, dank kind of uncomfortable conditions across the UK and across Europe as well. And we saw some extremely high prices right across Europe as a consequence of that. So I think that really shows, even in the winter now, that we're seeing some periods of sort of real price volatility in those two situations, which are both likely weather conditions across the course of the winter. Obviously, we all love the kind of blue, sunny skies and that kind of thing, but certainly in Britain, we get lots of grey days as well, right?
Yeah. we definitely do. To put some numbers on that, the 8th of January, I think, was when we kind of had the tightest period, and some of the prices taken for gas plant were £2,500 per megawatt hour up to sort of £5,000 per megawatt hour, which is kind of, it's just orders of magnitude beyond kind of where the market traditionally trades for that type of generation, which is typically kind of £100 per megawatt hour for gas. Hopefully some context on the types of conditions we're seeing coming through as the system transitions towards a more renewable system.
But I guess it's worth just pointing out though that these individual days kind of average out. So when you think about how much you're going to pay to supply customers across the course of winter, you know you're probably going to get one or two days of £2,000 or whatever. But the more days that are £50 or zero price or stuff, that's going to drag down the average. And to kind of go back to your question before, that will help lower consumers' bills in the long term. The more days where you have low prices, even if you can have a few days with really, really high prices, the lower the average cost is going to be.
And there's a role for kind of media in this, because the when you get the £2,500 or the £5,000 per megawatt hour price, 100% that will be on a newspaper headline. But it is very unappealing to write about a £25 per megawatt hour day or just a slight oversupply.
It was kind of normal again.
Yeah, it was kind of normal. It was a bit sunnier, so your bills might be a little bit lower. It just isn't the kind of sensationalist headline that people will write. So
I think it is interesting. I guess this podcast and things like this are helpful in that regard, because understanding the energy transition at large and what's going on is when I talk to people about it, they're way more interested than I thought they would be. Like I say, I thought no one would ever be interested in my industry. But actually, people understanding that stuff we talked right at the beginning, that link back to what people do every day, you can talk them through that and you get some real engagement from it.
I think so. So I wanted to touch on one more thing before I ask you the two final questions. And that is that if anyone's listened to this and they are a graduate coming through or they have just finished school and they're thinking energy trading, energy industry sounds interesting, fun. How do people get into those types of positions? How do people get into sort of energy trading?
Yeah, so OVO, we just ran a graduate scheme for a couple of years. We're not doing one this year, but hopefully maybe back next year. I would definitely keep an eye out for those. Graduate schemes are a great opportunity to enter and experience lots of different places around an energy company. You don't necessarily need to start in energy trading, I'd say, as well. So if you were to join a graduate scheme and then transition in roles over time towards energy trading, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. But to be honest, you don't have to join a graduate scheme. I've had some really amazing people that work for me without a background in who may not have a degree, but or might have a degree and they started in customer service, for example, but have shown sort of drive and determination and taken the opportunities, kept an eye on the job boards as they might be and moved towards it. There are some definitely skill sets which I think are beneficial. So a passion for it obviously makes a difference. An analytical mindset, is, I think, is really important. And for energy trading specifically, being able to sort of deal with uncertainty. And a lot of what we've talked about today is around uncertainty. Yeah. And be able to make decisions in uncertainty. It's quite a tricky thing to do. So you don't know with certainty whether this is a good trade or not, yeah? And you don't know exactly whether the trade is going to completely mitigate your risk or not, but you still need to make a decision because the worst outcome is freezing. And it's interesting that some super clever people will struggle to make that decision. So it helps to have a certain mindset and be able to kind of, you know, make the best possible choice, even though you don't know all the outcomes that are available to you.
Okay. Is there still like a trader's morning meeting where you kind of, everyone sits in a room who's 100%. Trading and on the right-hand side, there's like, oh, this could drive the price up. On the left-hand side, this could drive the price down. And people still kind of like balance that seesaw.
Yeah. So we still do that. I imagine other companies still do that as well. It's really important. It's a really important point, actually, being able to communicate and share views to come to like a consensus or a common view of what we think is going to happen and then take action on the back of that. That's critical. So yeah, that's probably an important skill to have as well.
Okay, superb. So anyone listening to this who has made it this far, but also really wants to get into energy trading, hopefully some useful tips there. So a final two questions. So the first of those two questions is there anything you'd like to plug?
On energy trading, not particularly. However, I'll take the opportunity to kind of plug for a charity that's important to me. So my eldest daughter has a condition called Prader-Willi syndrome. It's super rare, results in lots of complex difficulties, learning difficulties, and most kind of challenging really is not the ability to feel full. So always feeling like painfully hungry almost, and therefore not being able to kind of manage your diet and stuff like that. So it takes a bit of effort. It's a really unusual condition and therefore a small charity. So my plug would be to go out and have a little look at what that is. And if you're interested and like to make a donation to that charity, please go ahead and do so. And just to try and understand a little bit more. And maybe there isn't the charity for you that you want to support, but think about the small charities, I guess.
Okay, superb. And we can definitely put a link to the charity in the show notes as well, so
cool.
People can find it.
Prader-Willi Syndrome Association or the Foundation for Prader-Willi Research.
Okay, perfect. And on to the final question, which is, do you have a contrarian view? So something that you believe that the majority of the market doesn't?
So this is maybe not, and well, maybe the energy market, it's hard to know what the market thinks at large, but I'm a bit of a kind of like a car fan.
Okay.
Right. And if you kind of browse lots of YouTube videos about cars, like I do occasionally, lots of the comments are about how EVs are dead and things like that, right? I think that's, so my view is that 90% of people think in those environments think EVs are dead. I think that's rubbish, right? I was reflecting a little bit on this. I have a plug-in hybrid van for the family. I have a petrol car that probably produces way too much CO2 and am looking at transitioning to an EV and waiting and waiting and waiting. I think now we're starting to see the opportunity. So the Renault 5, super interesting car, like much cheaper, much better value. We're starting to see small, fun-looking cars again, like the Renault 5, like the Alpine A290, the Polestar BST 270. There's loads of like interesting, fast cars that'd be fun to drive in the UK. I think EVs have got it wrong. They think the story to date has been, I can go really fast in a straight line. in the UK, no one goes fast in a straight line. We've got corners. So like having fun going around corners is much more important. And we're starting to see cars that come out that will support that. So I don't think EVs are dead. I think they are just on the cusp of growing really quickly. I'm hopeful that, you know, the next car my father-in-law buys will be an EV.
Yeah.
And it becomes normalized. And that's because he's not buying a 600 horsepower monster that's completely unnecessary for him, but he can buy a 220 horsepower car that goes around corners, fun.
And part of that contrarian view is that we've focused too much on, like, say, straight line speed, but actually when it comes to EVs, a lot of the fun comes from the actual driving of it, going around corners.
Yeah, so like cars are
underappreciated.
Exactly. Cars are fun going around corners or on a track. And like, I live in the Cotswolds, right? So I have to deal with country roads that are quite twisty and occasionally overtaking a slow car, probably more than my wife would like. But that involves... yeah, cars that have good dynamics, right? And are fun to drive in that environment.
Yes.
And we're starting to see them happening. You don't need tons and tons of power in a straight line.
Yeah.
You do need fun in the corners.
I was really worried there for a second that we were going to go and try and explain what the magic roundabout was to our US listeners. And I just think that's better if that's completely left. But please feel free to look it up on Wikipedia. Gethin, thank you very much for coming on. You've been a fantastic guest. And
really
I really look forward to people listening to this and letting us know how they found it.
Awesome. Thanks a lot.